You know, the first thing I want to accomplish, Robert, it's a great question, is I want to attack our national debt. It's $16 trillion right now. The fact of the matter is, that's a $50,000 share for every man, woman, and child in America right now. You know, I'm running for Congress because I have three kids, Torin, Griffin, and Clark. Their share of the debt being $50,000, it's unattainable. It's immoral. And unfortunately, that's what we have to do in Washington. We have to have leaders in Washington who are willing to go out there, make some tough decisions, and be able to work in a bipartisan manner to attack the problems in this country. That's why I'm running. That's why I need your vote. And when we can begin to control spending, attack the debt, what'll happen, Robert, is we're going to be able to stop borrowing $3 billion a day that our country currently borrows just to pay the interest on the national debt. Imagine what we could do with $3 billion a day just to be able to preserve programs and strengthen programs like Medicare, Social Security, and reprioritize the way Washington spends money.
Candidate Gill.
First of all, I'd like to thank everybody for being here, and I'd like to thank all the sponsoring institutions. It's a very important part of the democratic process. I'd like to thank Mr. Davis for being here, too. There's many reasons that I'm running for Congress. I'm an emergency room doctor running for Congress, live right here in the Twin Cities with my wife, Elaine, and we have six children between us. And I work in the emergency department at Advocate Broman. It's just a few blocks away from here. And when I go to work, a fair part of my day is spent saving lives and bringing people back from the brink. And I want to go to Washington now to help bring this nation back from the brink. There have been too many people who have been struggling far too much for far too long here in America, and it's just not right. And in order to help with struggle, it helps if you've known struggle, and I'm somebody who has. I lost my father when he was a young man. He was 37 years old, and he didn't have time to store up anything, so we didn't have anything extra growing up. I was 13 at the time and had to go to work then, bussing tables and washing dishes, and worked my way through college and medical school at the University of Illinois, stocking shelves and mopping floors. I'm somebody who knows how to roll up his sleeves and get to work. I'm a small businessman as an emergency room doctor. A lot of politicians talk about small business people. I am a small businessman. Have to purchase my own health insurance as an individual. I know what that costs, and we can only afford to buy the mega deductible catastrophic type of policy. Unlike my opponent, I've never been on a public payroll. I've never taken marching orders from a politician. And I'm proud within this campaign that we don't take a single penny from the Wall Street banks and the large corporations that brought this economy to its knees 5 years ago and that have made life so very difficult for people. I think that that corporate dominance of our politics and our government is strangling our democracy, and we need to push back against that. And we can do that when we elect people to Washington that simply have the interests of ordinary men and women in mind and not the interests of ExxonMobil and Aetna Health Insurance. Thank you.
I want to remind the audience to hold your applause until afterwards so we can get through the questions, as many questions as possible. Thank you, though. Let's go on to we get a 30-second rebuttal by candidate Davis, and then we'll move on to our next question.
You know, I can't reiterate enough how serious the issues are in Washington, D.C. right now that we need to address. But it's, unfortunately, we have 20 days left in this political campaign to talk about some of those issues. My opponent consistently talks about not taking corporate money and attacks me when he knows corporate money is not involved in our campaigns. Unfortunately, some of those same Wall Street banks and corporate PACs that he continues to talk about on a regular basis just funded his campaign today to begin attacking me once more.
All right, thank you, candidate. Let's go to our second question. It's going to be presented by Emeritus Professor Bradley.
And actually, this question is a follow-up to what you just said. Given all the money that outside groups have contributed to both you and your opponents' campaigns and have spent on ads, what assurance can you give the people of the 13th Congressional District that you will have their interest first and foremost upon election? And you have the first response.
Well, of course, this is something that I have talked about at great length. I think that it's a part of restoring our democracy. My opponent has taken large checks from ExxonMobil, from Exelon, from Marathon, from Halliburton, et cetera. And my campaign refuses to do that. I also would emphasize my independence, that I put country first. I defeated the Democratic Party in the primary. I was not the handpicked candidate of the DCCC. My opponent and I had very different experiences with regards to the primary. I was selected in a process that involved 31,000 voters going out on a warm March day to select a candidate. My opponent was handpicked by 14 party insiders who signed a confidentiality agreement after that day in May. And so at the age of six, I discovered a passion within my heart for serving my fellow man and woman. That's when I decided to be a doctor. And it's that same passion that drives me to take this seat in Washington. I watch people suffer and die needlessly within our healthcare system because of the fact that we have far too many corporate-funded politicians in Washington from both parties. And I think that we need to push back against that and have people that come from ordinary walks of life and who will only answer to the ordinary men and women that make up the district.
Candidate Davis, once again, the question being, with so much money pouring in from outside resources, how can you make sure that you're going to put the needs of the 13th District first?
Well, first of all, it's because how I was raised. I'd like to say hi to my dad, who's sitting here in the front row. My dad just finished recently his last prostate cancer treatment. Welcome. I love you, Dad. My dad gave me an appreciation for public policy while I was growing up, working in his small business. I learned how decisions in Washington and Springfield can adversely affect or positively affect the way he operates his business. It affects his ability to hire and to create jobs. I learned an appreciation for public policy because of those conversations. And upon graduation 20 years ago from Millikan University, I decided to go into public service. I'm proud of the public service that I provided the constituents of the 19th Congressional District, the former 20th Congressional District, and that's what we're talking about on this campaign. It's because of that experience that I believe I'm going to be an independent leader in Washington, D.C., to be able to go in and make the tough decisions that are necessary and be comfortable telling Nancy Pelosi no, just as I am comfortable telling John Boehner no. I'm not going to be beholden to anyone. I'm not signing any pledges that will bind my hands in Washington and allow Washington power brokers to lord those pledges and pieces of paper over me on single votes. The only pledge that I'll make is to serve the constituents of the 13th Congressional District and the 14 counties that make up that 13th Congressional District. And it's that independence, it's this experience that's going to allow me to sit around the table and work with Republicans and Democrats to tackle the tough issues and make the real substantive changes that we need in Washington, D.C. today. I don't think anyone in this room would disagree that we have to grow our economy. And the only way we're going to do that is on the backs of small business owners like my dad to create the jobs necessary so that college graduates can begin to grow in this economy.
Candidate Gill, you get the final statement.
I find it interesting that you mentioned John Boehner. He'll be in Central Illinois headlining a fundraising effort for my opponent tomorrow in Champaign. This again, we need people that are there strictly for people. It's example after example of what happens when you turn over our government to the corporations. You get a Medicare prescription drug bill where Uncle Sam agrees to not bargain on price, even though Uncle Sam had 50 million Medicare lives worth of bargaining power, so we blew $2 trillion with that. You get these subsidies every year to oil companies, our tax dollars that we give to oil companies because these guys take checks from ExxonMobil.
Thank you. Our next question, since we're here at ISU, Illinois State University, we had numerous questions submitted by the students. And this next question is one of the top questions that was asked by the students. We'll get to the number one question later on here in the debate. But the next question is a top question from the students.
On behalf of the students, I want to thank both of you for participating in this debate. One of the top questions that the students emailed me about to ask is, when it comes to reducing the deficit, there's two ways to reduce it, cuts and or revenue. Are cuts enough? What would you cut? And would you even vote for a tax increase for revenue?
Candidate Davis.
Well, first of all, I think the debate we need to have right now is not about increasing revenue. It's about growing our economy. And the best way to do that, what I've been campaigning on for the last 6 months, is ensuring that we actually extend our current tax rates permanently. I talk to small business owners every day, the job creators in this country, and they tell me they need certainty. They don't understand what their tax bill is going to look like at the end of this year, let alone their health care costs. Let's give them that certainty so that they can invest in equipment, they can invest in inventory, and most importantly, they can invest in people. And when that happens, that's how the economy grows, because that's how jobs are created. That's how jobs are going to be available when the students at ISU graduate in May. And if we don't grow this economy, and some of the plans that my opponent has put forth are going to lead to job losses. As a matter of fact, his tax plan that wants to raise taxes on those making $250,000 and above, the revenue projected to come in will fund a whopping 11 days of government operations. And Ernst & Young has said it will cost Illinois alone 30,000 jobs. College students in Bloomington, let alone the other 8 universities and colleges in this district, can't afford 30,000 jobs leaving Illinois, because those are 30,000 opportunities they won't have.
Candidate Gill, are cuts enough to address the deficit, and what would you cut?
No, they're not. I got a degree in mathematics before I went to medical school, but you don't need a degree in math to understand exactly what you said, that there's two ways to approach a deficit. That's to raise revenues and cut spending, and we ought to engage in both of them. I'm very pleased to hear you acknowledge the truth of my position on stances tonight, Mr. Davis. I've listened for weeks to these negative commercials funded by the American Action Network, which is funded by Aetna Insurance, talking about how I want to raise taxes on everybody. I have no interest on raising taxes on everybody. I think that the millionaires and the billionaires should pay their fair share, but I would never vote to raise taxes on families making less than $250,000 a year. But we should raise revenues by having millionaires and billionaires pay their fair share, by having corporations pay their fair share. A quarter of the corporations in this country are paying zero or a negative effective tax rate. The study cited by Mr. Davis, Ernst & Young, that was sponsored by a Republican institution. I worked in the actuarial field for a year after my degree in math, and I understand the different ways in which one can do a study, and you can redo that study and wind up showing no job loss. We also need to cut spending. We have a priorities problem in this country, and again, it's because you've got politicians owned by Wall Street and big corporations. We need to stop giving our tax dollars to oil companies who are already making record profits on us as we pay nearly $4 a gallon at the gas pump. I'm a firm believer that the mission has been accomplished in Afghanistan, and so we need to exit from there and put the money that is currently being spent there into America. We have plenty of needs here. In fact, the military budget overall, I agree with President Obama when he says we should follow the suggestions of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Nobody knows better the needs of the military than those gentlemen, and I think that cutting the military spending by $500 billion over the next decade is another area where spending cuts can occur. But generally speaking, you need to do both raise revenues and cut spending.
Candidate Davis, you get the final statement here.
Well, David, thank you for reminding me that you did say you would like to raise taxes on the middle class, and you did it to help fund your health care plan. Your health care plan goes beyond Obamacare. It's H.R. 676. This is a plan that's going to actually, that you have said numerous times, will require a 2% income tax increase on all Americans. So he will increase taxes on all Americans. Now, cuts. Let's talk about some of the cuts that we need to make. And let's first start by ensuring, Robert, that we don't have any more cylinders and wasteful spending
time
on projects like that.
Our next question is also another top student question. And they want to know if you candidates support or oppose Obamacare. And then what would you do differently, if anything, at all? Let's start with Candidate Gill.
Had I been in Congress, and I haven't been in Congress, so I haven't been around there for H.R. 676. Had I been in Congress in early 2010 when Obamacare was passed, I would have voted against it, because it really keeps in place the existing power structure in which the private health insurance, who effectively puts a surtax on everybody that has private health insurance of 20% to 40%, it effectively leaves them in control of the situation. I would have preferred to have seen a public option and would have wanted there to be a public option in order to secure my vote for that. That said, I was very pleased this summer when the John Roberts Supreme Court did not throw the thing out the window. There's a lot of wonderful elements to Obamacare, things that we really should preserve, being able to keep your children on your policy until they're 26, especially in this day and age when it's so hard to find jobs coming out of a university like this. The inability of insurance companies to exclude people because of pre-existing conditions. That's a wonderful thing. The closure of the donut hole in the emergency department. I see senior citizens who fall into that donut hole and only can take their blood pressure medicine every other day. Those are good things. And so I think that on balance, it's good that Obamacare was left intact, but I believe that we can do even better. And that we can do better not by taxing people more, but by enrolling more people within a Medicare system whose overhead is only 2.5 to 4%. Uncle Sam's not in healthcare to make money, and that's why he's able to run it so efficiently. And he does it while taking care of the oldest and the sickest in our society. We can do even better than what's been done thus far.
Candidate Davis, do you support or oppose Obamacare, and what would you do differently, if anything?
Well, I support repealing and replacing Obamacare, and I'd urge everyone to go to my website at electrodney.com and see our healthcare plan, a true market-based approach that's going to cut costs for all Americans and still provide that health care safety net for those who are uninsured, underinsured, and underserved. Now, I am just flabbergasted that David has run for office for the better part of the last decade. He has a record of statements, and he once said that the first thing he wants to do in Washington is to stand up with John Conyers and pass H.R. 676, which ironically is named Medicare for All. But that is the furthest thing from the truth of what it is. It is not Medicare as we know it today. It costs $1.7 trillion a year and creates a whole new bureaucracy that's going to take away our ability to choose where and when to seek medical treatment. Now, I have a history because my wife is a 13-year colon cancer survivor. She was misdiagnosed for months. But because we had the ability to move forward and get away from the primary care physician that was misdiagnosing her, finally, we got to a specialist. He thought he'd find Crohn's disease in a 26-year-old. Instead, he found a colon cancer tumor. We were able to make the decision to where she got surgery and began 6 months of chemotherapy immediately after the surgery. You know what? 3 weeks ago, she just celebrated her 13th year of her last chemotherapy treatment. This is what I value in healthcare. It's medical choice. And what the plan that David wants takes away from us is our ability to choose our own medical destiny. It takes away our ability to put the doctor and patient relationship first. And I will fight to ensure that that happens while a member of Congress.
Candidate Gill, you have 30 seconds.
It's the private health insurance companies that keep you from seeing the doctor that you want to see. Uncle Sam lets people get a second, a third, a fourth, a fifth opinion. It's the private health insurance because they need to maximize it. It's mission number one, maximize investor return. They'll limit you to Dr. A, B, and maybe C. If you want D, E, or F, you got to pay out of pocket. What I would ask of Mr. Davis is he had that taxpayer-funded federal health care at the time of his wife's illness, and thank God she's alive. And I would ask that he offer that to all American citizens. I think that everybody should have access to a similar type program. The market-based safety net he discusses, someone dies every 12 minutes for lack of insurance.
Time. Thank you very much. And our next question will be by Emeritus Professor Bradley.
This is for Candidate Davis first. If elected, one of the first pieces of legislation you will have the chance to vote on is a new farm bill. What would you do in regard to that farm bill, specifically in regard to the SNAP program and also farm subsidies?
Sure. First, I want to say thank you to David for reminding me that that's exactly what we have in our health care plan. I would love to see the federal employee health benefits program sold nationwide to all consumers, to everyone. That's what our health plan does. It talks about selling insurance across state lines, just like the federal employee health benefits program, so that we can still preserve our ability to choose where and when to seek medical treatment. Farm bill. I think it's a dereliction of duty on Republicans and Democrats that they have not passed a comprehensive farm bill this year, especially during a year where we've had one of the worst droughts in our generation. What we have to do in that farm bill is to make sure that it includes a very strong safety net for risk management tools so that farmers have the crop insurance that they need so that they can have the certainty in what their overall costs are going to be. They don't have certainty now. They're not going to be able to project and spend money on new equipment, on new inventory, seeds, fertilizer, what have you. When you talk about the food and nutrition program, what we need to do is ensure that we work to get people off of it. That's going to lower the cost. And we have to do that by growing the economy, not by implementing laws like Obamacare that the CBO estimate is going to cost 800,000 jobs nationwide. You know, and the New York Times, not necessarily a conservative bastion, estimated that when implemented, Obamacare is going to cost America 62,000 doctors.
Candidate Gill, how would you approach the farm bill, particularly when it comes to farm subsidies and SNAP program?
I think that the failure of a farm bill to be passed does represent, again, this inability of the parties to work together. And I think it points to the importance of sending someone such as myself who didn't bow down before Democratic Party pressure, who stood up to them in the primary and succeeded in the primary thanks to 31,000 ordinary men and women that went out there. I think it points, too, to the intransigence of what we've seen on the part of this Tea Party-dominated House of Representatives. The Senate Democrats were willing to step out there. They were willing to make cuts to the SNAP program, and the House Republicans stomped their foot and said that they wouldn't come off of their mark. The Senate Democrats did, and the House Republicans refused to. And Mr. Davis is right. Farmers do need certainty. We saw with the drought this year, the disaster, driving around the 14 counties of this congressional district, I saw what was happening to the corn and listened to the farmers talk about what their needs are. And there's going to be more years of drought because climate change is a very real phenomenon. And we fail to address it as a government, again, because we've got too many people in government that take those big checks from ExxonMobil and similar companies. So we can address all of that when we have ordinary men and women who are only interested in the well-being of ordinary men and women, farmers and non-farmers. I would like to mention Mr. Davis mentioned this H.R. 676, Medicare for All, and it sounds as though you're acknowledging that I have some interest in Medicare for All, which flies in direct contrast to the other big lie that I've heard on TV about me for weeks and weeks, commercial after commercial. I've listened over and over. I've listened to seniors who are scared because of this deceitful lie, saying that I want to do away with Medicare. Nothing could be further from the truth. I've been a 20-year member of Physicians for a National Health Program, a group of 20,000 doctors that advocates for an expanded and improved Medicare for All program. And so to run commercials like that, I think, is shameful.
Candidate Davis, 30 seconds.
The plan that you've advocated for, called Medicare for All, during your previous runs for Congress and during your time advocating for a national health care system, is H.R. 676. It is the furthest thing from Medicare as we know it today. It will create a new bureaucracy at the state and federal level that will cost $1.7 trillion a year and take away our ability to choose where and when to seek medical treatment. If you want to build a new clinic, you have to get federal approval to do so. That's not what the Medicare system of today is like.
David? Time. Our next question is for Candidate Gill. If Mitt Romney is elected, he has suggested that he wants to put education funding back more towards the states. Do you see a role for the federal government in education, or should it be with the states?
I think that a lot of the decisions regarding education should be made at the state and local level, but I certainly see a role for the federal government with regards to funding. When I was a young person going to school, Uncle Sam would put upwards of 25 to 30% of the funding in, now it's down under 10%, and we see the impact. The education system in this country is failing, and we need to invest ourselves fully. Again, as I said, we have a priorities problem in this country. We've put two wars on a credit card. We gave a $2 trillion gift to the prescription drug companies that give big checks to Congress people, and we engaged in those tax cuts that largely benefited the richest in our society. Our priorities ought to be our children. There's a lot of kids going to school here who have far less access to Pell Grants than I had when I was going to school. Pell Grants used to be the dominant part of Uncle Sam's role in college education. Now it's a far lesser part, and we need to put our money into that. And so certainly this is one of the highest priorities that we have to have, is our future is at stake if we don't have an educated public, especially as we try to compete within a global economy.
Congressman Davis, once again, if Mitt Romney gets elected, he suggested putting education funding back more towards the states. Do you think there's a role for federal government in education?
There's a role, and post-secondary education is the key to that right now. This district has 9 universities and colleges and serves 7 community college districts. Anybody elected to this seat has to make education a priority. I'm in favor of increasing the amount of Pell Grants that are available to the students, just like the ones here at ISU. I want to make sure that we have access to federal student loan programs so that students can afford to go to college and then get that training to make sure that career is in their sight. When we talk about education funding from the federal level too, let's also bring it down to elementary and secondary education, where the federal government funds about 5% of the overall funding for our elementary and secondary education needs. But it seems as though they have about 95% of all the rules and regulations that those school districts have to follow. What we need to do is ensure, like Governor Romney said, ensure that more local control is put forth so that they make the decisions on how best to educate their students. They make the decisions on how best to ensure that their teachers are teaching. They need to make sure that they're the ones that have the priorities in mind for those students in hometowns, in towns all over this district, like my hometown of Taylorville. You know, I'm a public school graduate from Taylorville High School. I'm proud of that public education, and you know what? It taught me well. Many of my teachers may be here tonight, but you know what? We need to ensure that the federal government doesn't infringe on that local school district's ability to make the changes necessary so that those students learn at the level that they're expected to.
Ken and Gill, you have 30 seconds.
I'm proud to be recommended by the Illinois Education Association and endorsed by the Illinois Federation of Teachers because of my willingness to make education a very high priority. This discussion of Pell Grants calls into question something I've been wondering about with regards to my opponent for 5 months now. The Ryan budget calls for a 45% additional reduction in Pell Grants, and I've asked Mr. Davis if he supports the Ryan budget, and I've heard that he supports some parts and not others, and I would ask tonight, do you support that cut in Pell Grants?
Time. Our next question actually goes right along with that, and it's actually Andrew Mano is going to ask the question, and this was actually the number one most often question asked by the students. Go ahead, Andrew.
The number one question that was asked by the students is, will you do anything to reduce the cost of college, make financial aid more accessible, and more specifically, how will you do it?
Sure. What we'll do is we'll make sure that we reprioritize the way Washington spends money. We're going to cut the waste and fraud. We're going to go line by line through every single agency to ensure that we take that money and bring it into a reprioritization to pay down our national debt, because we have to put America on a debt repayment plan. And when we do that, we reprioritize those dollars. We stop spending and borrowing $3 billion a day just to pay the interest on the national debt. We'll be able to do a lot of good things in America, like increase the availability of Pell Grants, but still ensure that students have access to the federal student loan programs at an interest rate that's affordable and comparable to what the interest rates are in every community in this country. You know, it's essential that we allow affordable education for our students in this country. And frankly, I've got a 15-year-old daughter, and I see my 16-year-old niece. They're about to go to college. And what's going to happen is our family's going to have to figure out the same way to pay for that education, the way millions of families are in America, the way many of your parents are, if your students here today. And we're going to make those decisions as a family. But we have to have the options available to access from the federal government, and I intend to make sure they're there.
Congressman Gill, once again, what will you do to reduce college costs or make financial aid more available, specifically how?
Well, not a congressman yet.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right.
Whoa.
He did it to me, too, Robert.
I find it interesting. The cuts have to come from somewhere if you're not willing to raise taxes on the millionaires and the billionaires. And it's easy to say that you wouldn't cut Pell Grants as Paul Ryan wants to. And yet, I think it's important to understand where these two campaigns come from. You know, this is an insider against an outsider. Mr. Davis recently had a fundraiser over in Missouri with Eric Cantor, who friend of Paul Ryan. And these people are helping him. Aetna Insurance is pouring money in. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, made up of the large corporations, they're helping him. And they're not doing it out of the goodness of their heart. They're doing it because they expect something in return should he get to Washington, D.C. And that something would be to stand up for a budget such as Paul Ryan proposes, which would imply increased pain and difficulty for college kids. I think college needs to be more accessible, and we need to make it more affordable. And as I indicated, I think that Pell Grants should be far more readily available to young people such as yourself. And being that 75% of my funding comes from people just like you, ordinary citizens, an average donation of $61, the proof is in the pudding. That's why I'm going there to Washington to work on your behalf, to make sure that you can get to college and graduate and hopefully work to create jobs again within this economy so that you don't have to graduate with a mountain of debt and joblessness.
30 seconds.
I love the hypocrisy. Now, this is the same day that my opponent took money from Nancy Pelosi's DCCC, which is funded by many of the same donations that you accused me of accepting. It's easy to say something, but that's not reality. Insider versus outsider. Average citizens, most of your contributions are coming from outside the district, and some of the organizations that have, and they're coming from California, New York, and other states. Most of the groups that have funded you at the PAC level were the ones in favor of the stimulus bill.
Time. Our next question comes from Emeritus Professor Bob Bradley.
Okay, this is for Candidate Gill for the first response. If elected, would you support federal legislation that would allow concealed carry at public universities? If not, would you think that Illinois should pass such a law for public universities in the state of Illinois?
Well, I would. And I guess since I still have a minute and a half to go, I would say, Mr. Davis, you don't know where my individual donors who gave less than $200 live. So I wouldn't be telling a crowd of hundreds that you do know where they live. Done.
Congressman Davis, the question was, Congressman, can I... I'm just going to call you guys Davis and Gill from now on. All right. Well, what we have is, would you support concealed carry on campus, and would you support Illinois passing a concealed carry law?
Yes. Getting back to responding to what David said, I agree. I don't know who your contributors are, 200 and below. But the fact is, I do know who your large contributors are that you will be beholden to in Washington, and they're people from out of state. They're from New York, they're from California, they're from Florida. And what's happening is these are the same people that have been involved in working toward H.R. 676, a national health care system that's going to cost hundreds of thousands of jobs, and it's going to cost our Americans, every American, the ability to choose where and when to seek medical treatment.
Gil.
And my large contributors make up such a much smaller fraction of the money in my campaign than your large contributors do. 8% of your money comes from small contributions, less than $200. Far more than that comes from everyday, ordinary American citizens into my campaign.
Our next question is, and we'll direct it to Rodney Davis first, which is pertaining to states' rights. We have, here in Illinois, we have gay marriage issues, we have abortion issues, concealed carry issues. Where do you stand when it comes to the 10th Amendment, and how far should states' rights go?
Well, states' rights should be a priority. So that's what our system of government is. The Republican form of government that we have should ensure that the states have the ability to make the decisions that they need. It goes back to the education issue. When we talk about local control, even down to the school district level, we need to make sure that the federal government does not have their hands in requiring more than what is necessary to achieve the goals. And that's something that's a vast difference between David and me. It's our view of government and government's role in everyday society. I believe in a smaller, limited government that allows the states and the local governmental entities to thrive and to shine without unfunded mandates and decisions made in Washington that unfortunately will affect the way businesses operate here in Illinois. I mean, that's the public policy agenda I learned from my dad growing up watching him and my mom run their small business. How decisions made in Washington can adversely affect their ability to create jobs. And how many politicians have we seen over the years stand up and say, we want to create jobs, we need new jobs, we need to grow our economy. Well, frankly, government's got to stop getting in the way of small businesses so that we can create those jobs and grow this economy and get this unemployment rate down even further.
How much do state rights go when it comes to the 10th Amendment?
I think that states' rights are certainly important, very important, but there needs to be balance. And Uncle, there's occasionally a time for Uncle Sam to get involved in situations. I find it interesting to hear your discussion, Mr. Davis. It was, 9 days ago in Springfield that you asked for Uncle Sam to get involved by amending our Constitution, of all things, amending it make it so that to define marriage as between one man and one woman. And I think that that's uncalled for. There is a time and a place Uncle Sam needs to get involved. When there were poll taxes on people keeping them from voting down south, I think that it was appropriate for the federal government to get involved. This situation in Illinois with concealed carry, I see the victims of assault in my emergency department, people that should have had the opportunity to defend themselves easily and don't because of Illinois' intransigence with regards to passing concealed carry. And so I think there's conceivably a place for Uncle Sam, as I indicated, to become involved in that issue.
30 seconds.
Go ahead. Next question.
Okay. Our next question. Wind energy credits are set to expire at the end of the year. Ethanol subsidies already ended. Fracking is being introduced into the district. Natural gas vehicles are also being discussed. How would you vote on energy issues?
Well, I think that, energy is of extreme importance. It drives our economy, and I think that we need to focus on renewable resources with regards to the investment of the federal government and a government that stays out of the way with respect to the private market otherwise. Right now, we've got our tax dollars going. You know, your hard-earned tax dollars that you send in to the federal government go in the form of subsidies to the Exelons, the ExxonMobils, the people that send checks to my opponent. And instead of sending subsidies there, I believe that we ought to, if we're going to do anything with that spare money, if there's such a thing as spare money in this day and age, it ought to be invested in the green technologies of today and tomorrow. We've got 6 large universities in this district, people that are very interested in doing research with regards to renewable resources. We've got a tremendous wind belt that runs right through this district, and there's people that would love to get to work if they had subsidies available. I used to live down in Clinton, and they converted an old rail car plant. They're building the giant blades for those wind farms, and they got some governmental assistance. And So I would like to see us invest in that fashion.
Just a quick yes or no on this. Would you vote to extend the wind credits?
Yes.
Yes.
You have your 2 minutes.
Has it started yet?
Yes.
All right. I agree. Renewables are something America needs to continue to invest in. But it's not mathematical reality to think that we can run the American economy on wind, solar, and hydro alone. The rates for every single American will skyrocket because our supply is going down. Frankly, our supply is going down because of a burdensome regulatory environment that's shutting down coal-fired power plants in America as we speak. What we have to do is look at my energy plan. It's an all-of-the-above approach. We have to build more baseload generating facilities in this country. We have to ensure that we put more plants in action like the one in Clinton. Let's build more nuclear facilities so that America continues to lead the world economically. If we put ourselves at an economic disadvantage because we're meeting emissions targets that we're already doing better than most industrialized nations at meeting, let's make sure that we hold everybody else accountable in the world, because treaties aren't worth the paper that they're signed on if we don't hold everyone accountable. So let's start worrying about American energy and American economy. Let's build the Keystone Pipeline, number one. That's thousands of jobs that can be created right now here in America with a signature from President Obama. That needs to happen. Let's begin to look at expanding our baseload generating capacity in a way that makes sure we maximize our emissions controls, we build coal-fired power plants, we utilize natural gas, and we even look at expanding our nuclear options here in this country.
30 seconds.
Well, I wouldn't begin to claim that renewables can take care of all of our energy needs at this point in time, but you certainly need to take a big, strong first step forward. And we find ourselves unable to take that first step forward when we have Congress people that are beholden to the oil and gas companies. And I think that this issue is of the utmost importance, especially with all the young people in this room, because climate change is very, very real. I'm a scientist, a man of science who understands the reality of it and the fact that man's activities have put us where we are today, and we need to start taking action now.
Our next question comes from our student body president, Andrew Mono.
Given recent legislation such as the Stop Online Piracy Act, where do you both stand on regulation of the Internet? Kenneth Davis.
As limited as possible from the federal government level. since I have more time, let me talk about green energy. The same people that support David's campaign are the ones who got the biggest payback when President Obama was elected through the $800 billion stimulus bill that David has said he supported and said was working as late as 2010. It didn't work, okay? We hear a lot of talk about subsidies to oil companies. They don't even amount to anything close to what was given to green energy companies. We had $80 billion rolled out to help us grow the renewable energy sector. And what's happened? Solyndra, Fisker. And you know what? The cost per job from that stimulus bill in the green energy loan program is $6.7 million. It cost, funny you mentioned the internet, it cost $18 million just to put the internet site on so that people in America could track the stimulus funding. Now, you may want to change your major to computer science if you can get a contract like that to build a website.
Kenneth Gill, once again, what would you do about federal regulation of the internet? And this is also one of the top student questions.
I would agree with Mr. Davis, as limited as possible.
Do you want to take any more time?
No, let's go on to another question.
Hang on. I got 30 seconds.
30 seconds.
Stimulus bill. You know, I get attacked for my public service that I provided countless constituents to work through the bureaucratic red tape of Washington. Part of my job was to track stimulus funding on that $18 million website. And you know, one day I went there and I saw how much money had been spent by the Obama administration in this stimulus bill that David said was working. And it said $541 million. And you know what? Next column over, how many jobs created or saved? 543. $1 million a job in the 19th Congressional District of Illinois. That stimulus bill didn't work at all. That was a complete and utter failure and waste of money that we're still paying
time
interest on.
Our next question will be by our professor.
Okay. The 13th Congressional District, if nothing happens, is scheduled to have a large number of post office closings. So what would you propose to do to deal with the ever-increasing debt of the U.S. Postal Service?
Well, I think a large part of the debt related to the Postal Service is due to the fact that career politicians in Washington, D.C. set up a scheme by which the Postal Service had to fund 75 years into the future with respect to retirements and future pension costs and health care costs. And I think undoing that step would go a long way toward restoring the solvency of the postal office. I'm proud to be endorsed by numerous postal workers throughout the district and look forward to standing up for them when I get to Washington, D.C.
Candidate.
I don't know when one runs for Congress three times the better part of a decade when they become a career politician or a career politician wannabe. What has to happen when we talk about overall spending in Washington? We have to ensure that we look at the entire spectrum of where federal dollars are going. And that's what I talk about in my campaign every single day. I talk about making sure that we send people to Washington that are going to be able to delve into every single aspect of the federal budget. Make the cuts where necessary. Make the tough decisions that need to be made in Washington. And you need somebody that's willing to go there and do that. I'm willing to be that person if we're blessed enough to win in 20 days. It's going to take that type of leadership. My history of working in a bipartisan manner has gotten me endorsements from several Democrat mayors in this district because I didn't walk into their communities and ask, are you a Republican? No. There are no Democrat or Republican solutions to community issues. There's just right solutions. And that's what I intend to work for, and I've got a work history that proves it.
30 seconds.
I would just say that I'm sick and tired of seeing the career politicians in Washington, D.C. not standing up for the ordinary men and women. I've run previously as a committed standard bearer to the principles that all men are created equal and that the ordinary citizens that live here in Illinois 13 need a voice in Washington, D.C. They don't have some high-powered lobbyist. They're not friends with Eric Cantor or John Boehner. They need someone to stand up for them rather than leaving citizens to die every 12 minutes because they don't have health insurance.
Our next question is pertaining to Dodd-Frank. and financial regulation. Do you support Dodd-Frank? If you had an opportunity to repeal it, would you do so? And if so, then what other options would you propose?
Dodd-Frank needs to be changed. I mean, it is offensive when you go to State Farm just down the road, and they dedicate an entire floor to regulators. Different regulatory agencies take up office space on an entire floor. We as a federal government have to ensure that we make things work in a much more concurrent manner within the regulatory environment. A company as large as State Farm, right here in Bloomington, that provides thousands of jobs. Many of you may work at State Farm. It provides thousands of jobs, but they have to dedicate an entire floor to the regulatory environment in this country. That's why I support the RAINS Act. We're going to make sure that if we go into the regulatory environment, that we're going to do a cost-benefit analysis if there's $100 million or more of impact to Americans. That's something that has to be done. And that's what I'm not afraid to get into the weeds. I'm somebody who looks forward to the details. And when we see overreach in the regulatory environment, I view my job as a member of Congress to introduce a bill every single time to clarify that, to make sure that it doesn't cost American jobs.
Dodd-Frank, it's a step in the right direction, but it doesn't go far enough. It doesn't restore the wall between investment banks and regular savings and loans, and it doesn't go far enough, again, because of the Wall Street bank money that flows into Congress. You have too many of these guys that take too much of that money, and we see it on a daily basis. With respect to investment bankers, there's a couple up in Chicago who Mr. Davis is aware of, the Griffins, and I've asked this for 5 months as well. We passed laws in this state after Rod Blagojevich to change the way in which campaigns are financed, and the Griffins investment bankers had extra money to put into the Illinois Republican Party, but they were to be limited to a certain amount, and this took place when Mr. Davis, as part of his public service, was executive director of the Illinois Republican Party, and he found a way in which they could transfer that money to 20 different counties down here in central Illinois and then have that money funneled back up to the party through a Karl Rove dinner. And it's this influence that's bought by wealthy bankers that makes life so hard on the ordinary tellers that work within banks.
30 seconds.
David, you know that's not true. What you have described is not accurate. Frankly, you know, you talk about a negative campaign, that you've kept everything positive. You created an ad based on stories that have been debunked in many of the major newspapers throughout this district. David, I can't stand the hypocrisy anymore when you talk about Eric Cantor, you talk about John Boehner, when you just had a fundraiser in Chicago with Nancy Pelosi. You just had Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky down for multiple events. Who are you beholden to? Nancy Pelosi? Jan Schakowsky? Those who sponsor H.R. 676?
Time. Our next question will be by our emeritus professor.
Okay. Given our involvement in a number of military situations throughout the world, what, if anything, would you change about our military policy?
Well,
Gil.
I think, as I indicated earlier, I think that we should be out of Afghanistan already. It's mission accomplished there. Osama bin Laden is dead. The situation really got muddied with regards to what the mission was. I think that other than that, I think that we should recognize that Syria is a powder keg, but it's a far more complex situation than what you're reading about in your mainstream newspapers. It's really evolving into a holy war of sorts between Sunni and Shia, and I would tread very carefully, engage in all diplomatic efforts possible, but we've had far too much war in this country for the last decade plus, and I don't think that Syria or Libya, for that matter, or Iran today, is a situation that calls for putting the life and limb of young American men and women on the line. And so I would support the very severe sanctions that are taking place in Iran, and I would encourage ongoing trepidation with regards to getting involved militarily within Syria.
Kenneth Davis, you have 2 minutes.
I subscribe to the theory of peace through strength. I believe America is a beacon of freedom in this world, and we need to make sure that we take advantage of our place in the world to ensure that we use all diplomatic relations before going into a country. I subscribe to the Powell Doctrine, which says just that. But what we have to do is make sure that we listen to the generals on the ground. We are on a path to pull out of Afghanistan. We've pulled out of Iraq. I believe that pathway will continue through 2014, and we'll see our troops come home where they deserve to be. But we need to ensure that we have a strong military to be able to keep the peace through strength. Because what we saw a few weeks ago that still doesn't get enough media attention is we saw an attack. We saw an attack on American sovereign soil when the Al-Qaeda flag flew over the burned-out embassies and consulates across the other side of the world. We didn't see enough attention paid. Al-Qaeda and terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda view the Al-Qaeda flag flying over our soil as a symbolic victory in who they against who they call the Great Satan, the United States of America. And if we don't invest in our military to keep the peace through strength, the next time they come at us, which they will, we may not be able to respond as effectively. And we need to ensure that we respond to terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda, wherever they are in the world, and ensure that American citizens' safety is paramount to our military success.
30 seconds.
Again, I would reiterate that I would abide by what the Joint Chiefs of Staff have to say with regards to military funding. And we need to take our $16 trillion deficit seriously. My opponent's refusal to talk about raising revenues on corporations and millionaires and billionaires, that just blows another $1 trillion hole in our deficit. And this is an ideal place where cuts are available and where cuts are demanded by the people that know the military best, the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Our final question before we get to closing statements will be directed first to Candidate Davis, and it's going to be asked by our student body president, Andrew Malino.
Currently, Congress has the lowest approval rating in its history. Many feel that it is because of partisan politics and nothing is getting done. What specific areas do you see where you can come together and get things done?
Well, I've said it before tonight. We have to have bipartisan solutions so that we can move some real substantive changes forward in Washington, D.C. How do we do that? Well, what we do is we send people like me, who have a proven record of working in a bipartisan way, to actually get things done. That's why I said many mayors in this district that are Democrats have supported me. Many people I've worked with throughout my career in public service have a political affiliation that I'm not even aware of. And that's the way I'm going to operate in Washington, to be able to find those that we can work with to not just go to D.C. and vote the right way, but we're also going to be able to have leaders go in and lobby, be a person ready to make changes. Go get more votes for what is going to affect the 13th district the most in a positive way. And when we do that, you're going to see much more bipartisanship. You're going to see congeniality at the level that Ray LaHood and others in the past have tried to strive for, including Tim Johnson. And I look to follow in their footsteps and work in that bipartisan way to make sure that we don't see the polarization that's happening in Washington right now.
The question once again, what specifically would you do to come together to get things done?
I think there's many different ways in which to do that. And again, when we've got some Republican congresspeople there that refuse to take the checks from the oil companies and the drug companies and the insurance companies and the Wall Street banks, I look forward to working with them on behalf of working men and women. I'm running against a guy that takes money from Koch Brothers Industries. The Koch brothers are working to do great harm to working men and women throughout this country through destroying collective bargaining, a process that I thought was settled decades ago, and now we're fighting that fight again. I look forward to opening up the trade agreements, the NAFTA and the CAFTA, when we've got Congress people there who understand that we've lost more than a million jobs in this country because of bowing down before the powers that be that got rich because of those so-called free trade agreements. And I look forward to working toward health care reform with people on both sides of the aisle who understand that it's not just an issue of morality or health, it's also an issue of wealth. By taking the money from the Aetna Insurance, who funds the commercials against me, these Congress people fail to recognize that we ought to take that 20 to 40% of that money back. There's no reason why we should be throwing that away upon a health insurance industry run by people like William McGuire. He was the CEO of United Healthcare. When he retired in 2006, he received a gift of $1.6 billion. And that's money that came out of people's pockets for their deductibles and their copays and their premiums. It's obscene. When you do the arithmetic, William McGuire, he received $100,000 a day, every day, to treat himself to every day for not a year, not 10 years, 40 to 45 years. You know, while we have people suffering in this country, while we face a deficit the way that we face. So while we don't have jobs, it's that type of a disparity between the people at the very top who are paying off the Congress people and the regular working people who I stand for. That's what I look forward to working toward in Washington, D.C., fixing those things, whether it be Republican or Democrat that I'm working with.
30 seconds, and then we'll get into our closing statements.
I find it ironic that many of the same organizations that David just discussed are funding Nancy Pelosi's Democrat campaign congressional committee, funds that are being used by David Gill to attack me. The hypocrisy has to stop in Washington, because the hypocrisy is not going to give us the bipartisan environment that we need to make real substantive changes in Washington. I'm proud to be supported by many labor organizations, the operating engineers, the air traffic controllers, the sheet metal contractors, folks in organized labor who realize that my plans, my jobs plan, is going to give the trades and labor the jobs that they need.
We appreciate the candidates for coming up here on the stage, and I know the moderators, we appreciate you guys sticking to the times as best as possible. And we will now continue with our closing statements, and due to the coin toss, candidate Gill will get the final statement, so we'll start with Rodney Davis.
You know, we've talked about many issues, so I'm not going to rehash a lot of those, but I want to talk about my vision. My vision for our future is one of a smaller, a more responsible government, a government that lives within its means and balances its checkbook, just like every family in the 13th District has to do. It's a government that stays out of the way of our doctor-patient relationship when it comes to health care decisions, and a government that gives our small businesses the opportunity to grow, succeed, and have jobs available for when students graduate from college. The problems facing our country, they're not partisan.